This episode of the CMO Suite is brought to you by Uconex. Uconex provides digital solutions and teams to brands, CMOs, VPs, and marketers looking for true transparency in the biddable media space. From paid social and PPC to complex platforms like The Trade Desk, brands from across the world have connected to Uconex. Visit them at uconex.com. And No Kid Hungry. We're proud to promote No Kid Hungry and their many initiatives to help kids in need of meals. No Kid Hungry helps kids, not be hungry. Visit them at nokidhungry.com. And finally, we are proud that Season 3 of the CMO Suite is presented by the CMOCouncil.org as their official marketers podcast. The Chief Marketing Officer Council is the only global network of executives specifically dedicated to high-level knowledge exchange, thought leadership, and personal relationship building among senior corporate marketing leaders and brand decision makers. The CMO Council's 15,000-plus members control more than $550 billion in aggregated annual marketing expenditures and run complex distributed marketing and sales operations worldwide. For more information on membership, visit thecmocouncil.org. Kat, let's start the show.
You're in the CMO Suite, the podcast for marketers who want to be in the know, presented by Connectivity Holdings.
Hello and welcome to Season 3 of the CMO Suite. I am your host, Sean Halter, and with me today co-hosting is Stacey Horton. Hello, Stacey.
Hello, Sean Halter.
And also producing with us today is Kat. How are you, Kat?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for
asking.
She's
there and she is ready on the mic. We're super excited about our guest today. I'm going to call this a Season 3 Rewind. Our guest is Doug Zarkin. Doug is Chief Marketing Officer for Pearle Vision. He currently leads the transformation of the brand's global strategic marketing, e-commerce, visual merchandising, product promotion, and store design. And I'm going to say to him, welcome back to the show. Doug, how are you?
It is great to be back. I actually appreciate the introduction. I think I'm going to use that next time my dad asks me what I do for a living.
Listen, I'll copy and paste it. I promise I'll send it over to you on LinkedIn. So, Doug, this is actually a return for you. You were kind enough to actually say yes to our Season 1 when we were still kind of figuring out what in the heck it was that we were doing with this show. So I think we caught you maybe mid-flight into an airport somewhere from what I remember from that episode. And I'm sure you're probably like, who in the world are these guys? What are they asking me? My buddy DJ, the DJ, was actually doing the show with me at the time. I think it was like 10 or 15 minutes because, again, we were still trying to figure out like how to settle into what we wanted to talk to chief marketing officers about. And now that we're actually into Season 3, I feel like we really kind of hit our groove last year, and we've gotten a chance to just really dig into what this crazy industry is all about. It's not getting any easier, is it?
It is not getting any easier. You know, the complexity of our category in optical retail, but just marketing in general, everybody thinks because we live in this age of optimizations and personalizations and data that it makes the decision-making process easier. What it's actually done is it's sucked a lot of the instinctual nature of how marketers have built brands out of it and sort of forced the paradigm to shift a little bit more into what are the numbers telling you to do. And as you and I have talked in the past, I'm a firm believer that it's not data that makes decision. It's marketers and people making decisions using data. And that shift alone in thinking is, I think, one of the reasons why we're having some success at Pearle and navigating this complex landscape.
So the point that you just made, I think, is incredibly important. You did it one or two minutes in, Doug. You must have been thinking about just that. I know you say it a bit, but talking about the fact that it's people that have to use data to make those decisions rather than the data telling you what to do, or you're going to get lost.
For sure. I mean, because data is only really as good as the questions that you ask. You know, it's a beautiful day here in New York while we're taping, and if you ask a question a certain way, I can get an answer on a spreadsheet that basically says that today's weather is really, really cold and, you know, really, really cloudy. It just depends on the level and the scale and the way you ask a question. You know, the art and science of marketing isn't just in the ability to analyze data. The art and science of marketing begins with making sure you're asking the right questions in the right way.
Yeah. We were talking earlier that last season, I think we had, you know, 8 different countries represented from CMOs and VPs from all over the world. And so it was kind of like an international season. This season, we're trying to figure out our exact theme. We think we're going to call it A New Hope. Because the hope is, I think, for a lot of marketers that maybe next year won't necessarily be easier, but maybe there'll be enough knowledge of the points that you're just making that the amount of pressure and stress that's being layered onto CMOs and VPs, I don't know that it will lessen, but maybe there's enough knowledge that's starting to flow through to your point that you still need people to make some of those decisions, and you can't let the data push the decisioning down to some extent. Is that a fair...
You know, I think business and sports are always really good parallels. You know, think about a great pitcher who's having an off day. Doesn't matter that he's, you know, studied tape and he knows what his pitches are. If his body isn't feeling it, if his gut isn't feeling it, if he's not sort of reading the pace of the game, he may throw a meatball pitch and give up a three-run homer and lose the game. I think it's the same thing in business, especially in marketing. You know, data may help you drive good decision making, but if you lose the ability to get in touch with what's happening at the front line, especially if you're a service industry, especially if you're a brick and mortar based business, you lose that instinctual feel, and it makes it really challenging to get yourself out of a rut. So I think 2020 is sort of a bit of a step backwards into the bespoke model of marketing, where good marketers are going to recognize that they got to get out of the boardroom and get back into the environments in which your products and services are bought and sold to really get a good gut sense of what is happening, and then use the data to help you make those right decisions and refine your approach.
Yeah, and so to your point, get out.
Get out.
Get your feet dirty.
There's a reason why I'm a Delta Diamond. You know, it's not because I love traveling. It's because being out in the marketplace is an amazing way to stay true to your brand, stay true to your customers. You know, marketers are terrible listeners by nature. We like to talk. The worst thing you could have done for me today is give me this microphone. And I think that's true with all people on your podcast. We like to hear ourselves talk, but really the ability to hear yourself talk and make sense is predicated on first shutting up and listening, asking a great question, pausing, really listening to what a consumer is saying, but trying to figure out what they're not saying. And that's why that face-to-face communication is so important.
And so maybe to your point about the listening piece, you know, that's our hope to some extent with this podcast, is that maybe it does give, you know, some chief marketing officers or some VPs of marketing or even some CEOs that are trying to better understand what's happening in the space a chance to be able to hear from their peers about what are those struggles that they're facing, what are those pieces of advice that they can take a little nugget from and just re-remind themselves for the passion of why they got in this industry to the first place. And so even to your point, if you feel like you're overwhelmed with just stacks of data sitting on your desk and you're trying to figure out, do I need my math degree to do this? This isn't why I got into the space. Get up, go see some stores. Even if you're not selling a store-based product, go back out in the world and kind of figure out that consumers are still touching products. You still have to get out and kind of touch consumers in a way with either content or in person or whatever that is to be able to kind of tell your story.
The most powerful research tool on the planet is the power of observation, just like the most powerful marketing tool on the planet is word of mouth. Those are not things you can control actively. You can seek to understand. Put yourself in the situations where you can really observe the small things. You know, at Pearl, one of the things that we've done really well is really focus on the importance of building trust with our patients through small moments. Those small moments are not going to register on a 2x2 matrix on an Excel chart. It's going to register by watching, listening, learning, talking, asking a good question, and then pausing and really getting a sense of the needs, the wants of the people that you're trying to motivate to take the action that you need them to take.
And so you're based here in New York.
I am.
Travel quite a bit for the company, as you talked about.
I do.
Did you grow up here? I don't remember where
you were. So I'm originally from Boston. I lost the accent because we moved when...
There's still a hint of it in there, but yes.
My family over the Thanksgiving holiday sounds like a bunch of drunken sword fishermen. I think I understand every fourth word. But fortunately, they're not Patriots fans, or that would be a dead day. I grew up outside of New York City. I moved there when I was four. And have lived in the greater New York area since graduate school. And finally, after my wife was pregnant with my son, we decided, you know what, do we want to, you know, overextend ourselves and buy a 3-bedroom apartment and eat ramen noodles for the rest of our life? Or do we want to have a backyard and a grill and a driveway? And so we made the move out to Long Island about 9 years ago.
And so how old is your son?
My son is 9 and my daughter is 11.
And so how is that travel with that? Do you just have to, like, every other position, you have to figure it out and just find a balance and make sure that you're there for as many of those moments as you can be?
So I think the hardest job that I have is not even on my resume, which is being a father. And for me, what I try to do is I've become an expert at sleeping anywhere. So, you know, if I have a...
It
depends how boring you are today.
Fair enough.
You know, I'll take that early morning flight and that red eye to get home to make it a 1-day trip, not a 2-day trip, because I coach my son's lacrosse team. You know, I love being there for my daughter when she's doing her dancing recitals. You know, part of why you work so hard is to live a great life. And so I try to keep that balance. My office in New York, I actually have two of them. One of them happens to be about 5 minutes from my house. So when I'm home, I'm really home.
And that's, again, where you find the balance. You hate to use that you know, the term work-life balance, it gets overused to some extent. But again, I feel like that's part of what this journey is for, especially for those of us who, you know, who aren't 25, who aren't just getting into, sure. into the business. It's figuring out what are we doing this for and who can we work with that we have fun with that can bring joy to us, that will work hard, but also allow us the chance to be able to get home and see our kids and do all that.
You know,
kind
of technology
stuff.
Makes it incredibly easy to work anywhere.
Is it too hard because technology is so easily available? Just meaning our phones seem to live by our sides at all times. We are always readily available. Somebody sends me a text. If I don't reply back to them within 10 minutes, sometimes it's a surprise to them. Is it too much?
You know, it's interesting. Some people will say, put the phone away, relax. I would rather have the phone next to me and know that the world isn't blowing up or worried than I'm not going to turn on my phone after 4 days and have 550 emails, which is actually pretty reasonable to happen. I would rather, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, if I'm on holiday with the family, you know, as the kids are getting down to sleep because they're young, check my email and answer a bunch of things for the next day. And then a couple times during the day, you know, if you're lying by the pool, you know, and you can get great Wi-Fi or cell reception, it's fine. You know, if you want to get on a call for 10 minutes, you can deal with the oceans cracking in the background or potentially me dropping my phone because I have suntan lotion on my hands. All right. I would rather do that to be able to know that things are moving forward. Because, look, I the reason why I got into marketing was to make a difference, not as a CMO, but as Doug. And I think hopefully one of the things that has helped me achieve to whatever degree of success I may have achieved is the fact that it's personal for me. You know, especially at Pearle Vision, these are local business owners who have trusted me to help build their business. They're counting on me to drive growth in their location so that they can pay for their mortgage and their kids' college. That's not a 9-to-5 thing. And I think I'm very lucky that I've recruited a team of people around me that also share that sentiment that this business is personal. And I think, frankly, that's why we're winning.
And so talk to us a bit about just that. What is that process for you guys? Do you end up kind of building an overarching strategy for national, and then you have to kind of figure out ways to localize that market by market, because Austin and what moves the brand in Austin might be different than what motivates people in Akron? Is that how you kind of build those pieces together, or what's the process look
so
like?
So our franchise agreement is very specific in the sense that it requires us to spend a certain percentage of the funds that every eye care center contributes to the marketing campaign locally. So in the DMA of New York, we have, you know, over 40 locations. We take the aggregate sum of the dollars that they contribute. We spend about 25% of those dollars locally at minimum. And for us, the opportunity to be a national brand that wins in the neighborhood means that you have to develop a national platform, but really think locally. You know, we call it the 5-mile battle and 9-mile war, because roughly about 80% of our patients live within 9 miles. And if you think about it, average speed limit in the suburbs is about 30 miles an hour. Who's traveling more than 25 minutes to go see their eye doctor unless you live in, you know, Bubble County, where there's not a lot of them? So we really try to emphasize winning that local battle for hearts, minds, and share of voice. But Pearle Vision is an iconic national brand, and so for sure we have to have a strong foundation.
We had the VP of marketing for the Trade Desk in here just a little bit earlier today for an episode. And, you know, one of the things they really specialize in is, again, just boiling down, you know, almost to the store level to some extent. And so how is digital marketing changing for you guys with that ability to be able to be that granular all the way down to an individual store level? How does that come into play in the overall strategy that you guys are trying to build?
So it's a dangerous slope, because if you start getting into the mindset of it, it's all about efficiency. You know, what you end up is finding the cheapest place to play, not the most effective. And I'll use an analogy that I use with our agency all the time. You know, if there are two nightclubs on the same street and one nightclub has a $20 cover charge, but that nightclub has all the beautiful people and has U2 playing and it has the best booze, the $20 cost per entry is worth it versus the club that has no cover charge that is serving, you know,
the cheapest beer, the cheapest liquor.
You
and I are hanging out.
And has,
front.
You know, karaoke.
Yeah.
You have to figure out where the right opportunity is and then try to find the efficiencies within that. And I think that's the same challenge when you look at national versus local. You know, there's a balance. There are some things that are better done on a national level from a cost per thousand standpoint. There are things that just make sense to do nationally. But there are a whole handful of things that are important to do locally, because you do want to communicate that authenticity that comes from being in the community.
You're one who I feel like is often good at giving advice. do you feel like you're good at taking advice? And what's a great piece of advice that maybe somebody's given you recently?
I've gotten better at taking advice. You know, I'm fortunate that I keep in touch with a lot of some of the junior people that I've had the chance to work with over the course of my career. And I spend about an hour and a half a month on phone calls with them, even though I don't work with them anymore, just because, A, they're amazing people who have made a difference in my life, but B, because one of the things that I love to do is to teach. But taking your own advice is challenging. I got some advice probably about 4 years ago that I think shifted the paradigm of how I as a leader led. And it was really the 80-20 rule. It's not necessarily what you think the 80-20 rule is. The 80-20 rule
is that when you're 80, you should not.
Date 20-year-olds? No, that's not what it is. It really is that 80% of the time, getting something to the 80% level is 100% acceptable to go forward, to make a decision. It's 20% of the time where that extra 20% is absolutely required in order to go to launch. And so it's a little bit of the, you know, diminishing returns analogy, but it's actually affected the way that I work with our creative agency. It's affected the way I work with our media team. It's affected the way I work with my team, because as somebody who innately is a perfectionist, I always want to be perfect. But don't lose sight of celebrating the progress on the pathway to perfection. And I think there are some times where you have to ask yourself, is giving that piece of feedback really going to make a difference, or is it just going to be annoying? And I think I've gotten better. There are moments for sure that in retrospect, I'm like, why did I make that comment? But that's the beautiful thing about working with people that you trust, is that not only will they allow you to do that, they'll tell you and they'll give you the opportunity to learn from it.
Well, that advice is great advice. And so I'd like to stay on it for a second, because, you know, I don't want to say it's profound advice, but it's an incredible reminder to all of us. You almost feel like perfection is required anymore, and that you'll be held to task if it's not exactly perfect. But the point is a very fair one, which is at some point you should be continuing to try to celebrate the journey. And sometimes 80% is okay to move forward with, and you'll learn from that. You know, I think, to us, one of the most interesting things sometimes is that mix of clients. Sometimes you have those clients that expect perfection. The best clients are those that say, we get that this is a test, and let's all learn from this. When you sit in a room with a CEO and they say to you, let's all learn from this, that's the most incredible. To me, it's the reason why you try to stay in the business to some extent.
You know, there is such a thing as a successful failure. You know, if you've learned something and it's given you an insight into not to make the same mistake twice, then it's worth it. You know, I ascribe to sort of the three levels of errors. The first are the learning experiences, and I have them every day, we all do as people, and that's when you encounter something and you've made the wrong judgment call the first time. A mistake is when you've encountered that situation, that exact same situation, and you've made that same error in judgment a second time. And then there's the, what I call, we have to have a conversation, which is when it becomes a repetition. And, you know, when you start getting into that third level, that's when you realize you have performance challenges with your people and you need to have, you know, what in the HR world they call the meaningful conversation.
And that's just a reminder, again, almost back to that 80-20 of you can't expect perfection each time. Take each moment as a learning moment, maybe to some extent, with your own employees. And the other point that I think that you made with that is just the fact that before you throw the comment out there, before you trash the work, is what I'm going to say, is it going to be productive? Can it be helpful? Can it be couched in a way that allows this employee to still feel like they're winning and that they're not getting kind of called to task some extent?
In business, and I think as importantly in life, and I talk to my kids a lot about this, the how oftentimes is more important than the what. You know, being a strong leader who's standing atop a mountain waving a flag of success with absolutely nobody with him, A, it's lonely, B, is boring, and C, is not going to get you far, because anybody can climb a mountain once. But what happens when you get stuck on the way up? If you don't have people behind you, and in some cases in front of you to help you navigate, you're screwed. It's something I talk to my son a lot about in sports. My son is, he unfortunately doesn't recognize his genetics that he's not going pro, but he, you know, he has dream, he lacrosse, baseball, football, and he's an intense competitive kid. And, you know, I talked to him about winning and losing, and, you know, Ben, sometimes you played a great game, you lost. It's going to happen. But what did you learn from it? And I try to keep that advice myself as just a person, not just a father. And I guess maybe it's helping me mellow a little bit as I hit this sort of chapter in my career.
Yeah. And so for those in the industry, I think part of the struggle, you know, to your point, is as if you're standing on the mountain, is your team behind you? And if they're not, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily a failure as a leader. It may mean that as with any team, sometimes you have to trade out those players. You know, this is as hard as it is for chief marketing officers or anybody that's at that C-level in the space to learn what's happening. You're also asking sometimes your teams that have been used to doing the way that they've been doing it.
The single most important thing that I hire for is passion. I want people on my team who frankly give a shit. Because I can teach you a job. I can't teach you to care. I can't teach you that on a Sunday night before Monday morning that you go into your email and check. I can't teach you Thursday at 5:30 as you're packing up and that phone rings to answer it. I'm not going to stand over you. I don't believe in checking in, checking out. We don't do time cards. I think it's ridiculous, especially in this day and age. Giving people the opportunity and the flexibility to work from home is critical to work-life balance. But I expect you to do the right thing when nobody's looking. And that is what I am looking for. I had a guy who interviewed with me probably about 5 years ago, and he said to me, I said to him, you know, you've got a great resume. You've done a lot of things in your life. Why should I hire you? What is the single most important thing about you that separates you? And he goes, I went to Harvard. And then I hired the community college kid. And I will tell you, one of the best hires I've ever made.
Yeah. I think it's also fair to realize that people change. Maybe you've hired them and they had that passion and then they got a different job opportunity or something else came into their life or they decided to move. Sometimes we can take that so personal as leaders. You know, we've had some amazing employees throughout my time of owning some of these companies, and sometimes the best thing that's happened is somebody maybe who's left and then comes back, or somebody who's left and sends me a note saying, hey, I didn't tell you this on the way out, but I really learned a lot from you along the way, and I appreciate all that opportunity that you gave me. Sometimes you have to be willing to let go.
It is the power of the word thank you is not lost on me when it comes to talent. There are some people who just intellectually and emotionally aren't good fits and you have to part ways, and those conversations are hard, but are still good people. There are some people that leave for work-life balances. We had somebody on our team who moved out of New York to New Jersey. And as a result, as opposed to being in a position where we may lose this person, work from home on Fridays, you know, and if need be on Mondays, you know, to cut your commute. You're getting it done. That's absolutely fine. But there is nothing, to me, more painful than losing somebody who not only does a great job, but you care about as a person. Because you're a family. I mean, you spend an exorbitant amount of time with these people.
True. As we start to wrap, I told you that was going to be half an hour, and that went fast, didn't it?
It did.
What do you wish you knew more about? Again, with this theme of hope, maybe to some extent, you hope that next year becomes, it should be an interesting year, certainly with, you know, if you take all the politics out of what the national conversation will be about, what do you hope you can learn more about in this space?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I think there is still a tremendous amount of ambiguity around alternative video, you know, whether that's OTT, whether that's YouTube, you know, being on non-traditional, non-linear television is the sexy thing to do. And we're doing it, but I think we're doing it in a pretty smart way. That world of what is coming, which eventually will be programmatic television, I think is terrifying. You know, it used to be easy. I started out as a media planner. It used to be easy to buy media. It is incredibly hard. Buying video right now is nearly impossible. You don't necessarily need to have an MBA. You need to have a PhD in street smarts, because there's a lot of smoke and mirrors that are out there. I'm hoping to get a much better sense of what is happening in that space to help us make smarter decisions on whether we maintain stronger budgets in linear TV, whether we move to some of the alternative channels that are out there. Really trying to get a little bit smarter on what's happening within the Google, YouTube universe. And these are all things that, I guess from a marketing perspective, keeps me up at night. The thing I'm hoping to get much better at next year, I still cannot tie a French braid for my daughter. It is unbelievably frustrating. I can plan $50 million marketing budgets.
But you can't.
I can go on network television. I can sit here with people like you. But, you know, put an 11-year-old with long hair in front of me and say, Daddy, tie a French braid. I can't do it. So anybody who's listening, hook me up. I'll be willing to trade you a pair of Ray-Bans for a really easy guide into how I tie a French braid.
There's probably a YouTube video out there somewhere that will teach you that along the way, Doug. I'm not entirely sure.
I can't be that dad. Like, there has to be a cool dad where I walk in and sort of like, exactly, done.
Away it goes.
Done. I'm not looking at the step one, step two pause thing. I won't do it.
Forget everything else.
Tying a knot, tying a great Windsor knot, fine. French braid, it's something I have to master it before she becomes old enough where she won't wear it anymore.
I've passed that point. I was the referee for my daughter and my wife when they came to figuring out just her hair in general. I was literally the person kind of in between. But listen, that's the biggest takeaway of the day is forget all this marketing stuff. Learn how to tie a French braid. So, you know, if you have a daughter.
First listener who can get in touch with me to give me an easy way to tie a French braid, there may be a pair of Ray-Ban aviators in the mail for you.
Well, listen, Doug Zarkin, thank you so much for coming back in, joining us for the show. We're going to hit you up to do a Ray-Ban giveaway this year. I told you Charlie Cole gave us an amazing backpack for season two. Oh, my God, it was so awesome. Doug has been telling me for almost a year now, let's do some kind of a Ray-Ban giveaway, for crying out loud.
I
will you finally commit?
I have a pair of Ray-Bans that I am willing to give away.
They're probably 2 years. They're not 2 years old or like your old
the
travel ones, are they?
The aviators are the most classic, iconic frame on the planet. One out of every two sunglasses in the world sold is a Ray-Ban. So
they look great.
Anything from it is going to be fine. Trust me. I'm not going to send you something. I'll even send you a brand new product. I won't even give you a refurbished one. I'll give you a brand new pair still in the plastic.
You know, when we interviewed Jen Say last year, I actually went out and bought a pair of Levi's so that when she came in, I was wearing my Levi's. I have my Ray-Bans with me. I should have put them on to start the show, but I'll make sure that Stacey at least gets a picture of me with mine so that you know that I'm a fan.
Not a problem.
Listen, thank you guys for joining us for this episode of the CMO Suite. If you want to find out more about Doug Zarkin, obviously do what I do and just stalk him on LinkedIn. If you want to find out more about Pearle Vision, you can Google them. And of course, if you know how to tie a French braid, do the same thing. Find it on YouTube or build your own YouTube and send it our direction. Kat, thank you very much for taking us out of the show. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for hanging out in the CMO Suite. The podcast for marketers who want to be in the know. Presented by Connectivity Holdings.
You're a C-level manager. You shouldn't have to know the difference between behavioral or contextual targeting. But your agency should. Uconnects provides brands and biddable teams direct access to platforms like The Trade Desk, Google, Amazon, Facebook, OTT, and more. Their U.S.-based traders can train your in-house team or provide complete transparency with no minimums and CPM-based service pricing for true transparency. Something Mighty Hive, The Trade Desk, and Centro simply don't offer. Tired of being the smartest one in the room? Reach out to Uconnects today for a free demo. Uconnects, the world's leader in true, transparent, biddable media.